by Boca Raton, Florida, who literally created an entire Kila Kadosha, one of the most outstanding communities in America today, and now has gone on to become the dean of Yeshiva University of the Jewish Future. And we are greatly honored to have such an outstanding Rav and Talmud Chacham to present a shiur to us on the most important topic. This is a shiur that is given L'Zecher Nishmas, Mr. Max Grimblatt and Mrs. Wildman, Aleihem HaSholom. And certainly we are reminded of the first Rashi in this week's Sedra of Yitzias Tzadik Min HaMokom Oisa Roshim, that when tzaddikim leave, they have an impact, and in their loss and their absence is felt. And certainly that is true for these two wonderful individuals. And we would like to just express our deep appreciation to Danny and to Zelda for making this evening possible. And I'd like to call upon Danny to give the introduction to Rabbi Brander.
I thank you all for coming, and I promise you the heat is coming on. So we should warm up in a couple of minutes. I'm going to talk longer than I should, but forgive me, I say. It's an honor to be hosting Rabbi Brander in our community, and I'll go through a little bit of his bio first, but I want to sort of personalize it on the way. Rabbi Brander was a YU undergraduate and finished smicha there in the 80s. He was not only a Talmud, but also a shamish of Rav Soloveitchik. He actually shares this obsession with many people in our community who are Hasidim of the Rav, if he would have allowed Hasidim. He has a very moving chapter in the book called Mentor of Generations, a short biographical sketches that were reprinted from the commentator into book form recently, and I recommend everyone get the book and read it, and particularly Rabbi Brander's very moving chapter. He quotes the Rav having once said, the story behind it is important to read, but he had once characterized his shamus, Rabbi Brander, as even the Satan doesn't have as good an assistant as I do. So Rabbi Brander, as you heard, is Rabbi Emeritus of the Boca Raton Synagogue, which in the 14 years he was there showed explosive growth of an order of 10 times its size under his leadership. He built a community kollel, Yeshiva High School. He led the establishment of a campus that houses all the Torah institutions in Boca, plus oversaw the building of two satellite communities in the general Florida area. And so one could sort of, characterize his time there as the nefashot that he made in Shah Subuch Haran, all the souls that he brought closer to Torah in the wilds of Boca Raton, Florida. During the course of his rabbinate there, he studied at Machon Pua in Yerushalayim, took expertise in medical halacha, especially infertility and gynecological issues in halacha, where he finished in 1999 and got a special ordination from them. He's currently a PhD candidate in philosophy at Florida Atlantic University, and Rabbi Brander, finish it now, believe me, if you don't do it now, it'll never happen. He's received numerous awards for rabbinical leadership in Florida, including the Key to the City of Boca Raton. He was a recipient of the YU Wexner Rabbinic Leadership Award in 1999, and he received the State of Israel Medal of Honor for work he did with the region of Gush Etzion. He recently was the first recipient of the Bernard Revel Memorial Award from YC alumni. He is currently, as you heard, the dean of the Center for the Jewish Future, Yeshiva University, since its establishment under Richard Joel in October of 2004. As I said, I wanted to personalize some of this, and actually there are quite a number of connections. Our lives, both as a community and personally, have intertwined in various ways with Rabbi Brander, unknown to either of us, I think, until now. But one thing that many of us were aware of is that our own Ben Bayit from our community, from our shul, Josh Fass, did his kollel time in the kollel that was founded by Rabbi Brander and then later became his assistant rabbi. And in my terms, Rabbi Brander mentored Josh into the sort of one of the gedolim in the sense of doing big things for Jews in the world today. And so Josh is, if I'm sure everyone here knows about Nefesh B'Nefesh, the organization that brings people in Aliyah. That's what Josh has been achieving all these last years. But his very first flight was the one on which my son Ellie and his family moved to Israel. The CJF, the Center for Jewish Future, is actually a successor to what used to be called YU's Community Service Division. And the CSD sponsored YU seminars throughout the late 50s, 60s, and early 70s, which is not only responsible for the fact that Zelda and I are from today, but also for our shidduch. We've met at YU seminar. And so, Rabbi Brender, you're inheriting a very a serious role in the Jewish community, but one that I'm sure that you're working very hard at and will succeed with. The CJF also sponsors Kolel Yom Rishon on Sunday mornings for the men and the Midrashat Yom Rishon for women, at which Rabbi Brander, we've had the pleasure of hearing him as one of the Magidei Shir there. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but the Shiurim are loyally attended by many people from our community every Sunday morning. Also, finally, again, our family intersection. The CJF sponsors many programs for young rabbis and rebbetzins throughout the states, in which our children, Moshe and Yonit, have been beneficiaries of that program and have enjoyed participating, and Rabbi Brander's influence on them has been already important. So tonight's topic is about reproductive technology, which is providing many new avenues for women who are having struggles with infertility, couples who are having fertility or gestational challenges in having children. New York Times Magazine actually centered on the issue of surrogacy. And my reading of this article was not so much about the scientific background, but about the human struggle for wanting to have children and why it's an important thing. So what are the options for from couples? And I guess that's what we're hoping to hear from Rabbi Brander tonight. The obvious relation to the recent partio is too good for me to pass up, and I understand Rabbi Brander will take this a step further. But from Sarah and earlier partiot and Rachel today, we hear the first surrogate relationship between a husband and wife, where the woman is not having children and provides her shifcha to her husband to bear a child. And at least in Rachel's case, and also later with Leah, the child is considered to be hers despite the fact that there's no genetic connection. But even more so, on a more basic level, from Sara Imenu to Chana Hanviah, we see that many Jewish women, and includes Rivka last week, have faced issues of infertility, of not being able to have children. And yet in each case, prayer was the key for opening their wombs. Why do we learn halachot tefillah, which we do from particularly Chana, from Chana's prayer for a child? Why is prayer and a woman's prayer for children the one instance from which we learn so many halachos about tefillah? And perhaps, just a suggestion, but maybe this is like the ultimate need for which only God can help. And that's why the human primordial scream to God for help is why true tefillah needs to be based on that case. As the Rabbi mentioned, we were sponsoring tonight's talk by Rabbi Brander, Lezecher Nishmat Imi Morati, Ada Weilman Chai Yentel Bastover Halevi, and my father-in-law, Mordechai Gimple, Ben Moshe, Alva Shalom. Just wanted to make a very loose connection with the topic tonight. Among the many challenges in my mother's life was the fact that she suffered through losing an adult child, a precious nefesh that caused her undue pain. She often had said during his illness that she'd rather that she be the sacrifice and not him. Could she give him the liver that he needed, even though she was well into her late 80s at the time? During the Shiva for her this summer, the emerging themes about my mother's personality was her perseverance and also the power of prayer, the role it played in her life. My father-in-law, who was a Holocaust survivor, most of you know, who never lost his faith in the Kadosh Baruch Hu throughout the years of living in that hell, lost his whole family and entire communities, and every nefesh for him after that experience was ever more precious. He also had for us the message of perseverance, of overcoming odds, and hope in the Jewish future. That was the point. And so they both would have understood the struggle, the need to have children, the sacrifices people make to make that so. And then finally, as a pitch, we felt that it would be an opportunity tonight, as long as we have a captive audience, to try to collect a little tzedakah, zecher der nishmot, as well as it's always a good thing to give tzedakah. And we picked one of our favorite tzedakot. It's called Just One Life, Nefesh Achat B'Yisrael. There's a theme, Nefesh, throughout here. Just that you should know, the director in Israel, Nefesh Achat B'Yisrael, is Madeleine Gittleman, who is an Olah from our community. One of the first couples we met when we moved here 35 years ago, approximately. They made Aliyah about 33 and a half years ago. And for the last at least 25 years or so, Madeleine has been the director of Nefesh Achat in Yerushalayim, where they have saved to date over 10,000 Jewish babies. And their work is important and very basically, they are referred to by many, many social agencies in Israel. It's not just serving the Frum world, but serving the world of all Jews in Israel. There are brochures about them out on the table when you leave, and there are envelopes. If you want to send in a check yourself, or you can drop a check in the box. I very much appreciate your tzedakah. And with that, I'll finally introduce Rabbi Brander. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is truly a privilege to share words of Torah here. Brishus the Mora da Asra, Rabbi Kaufman. I want to also thank Danny and Zelda for asking me to share words of Torah in memory of Max and of Ida. And speaking about their children, they have in a short period of time really taken Aventura, and indeed the entire South Florida area, by storm. His recent building of a shul, the work that he has done to both attract those who are been involved with Judaism all their life, as well as those who are new to observance, both Americans as well as Israelis, is well known. And you should be very proud of what they're accomplishing. And he is truly not just a rising star. He is already, they're both stars. Each in their own right, and they're really doing holy work in Aventura. You should be proud of them, and you should go visit them on weekends like this. It's freezing here, and it's very warm there. It's very warm there in a whole bunch of ways because of your children. And it's always a pleasure, although a little intimidating, to share anything that has to do with science in front of the dean of Yeshiva University, of David Sorowitz. Hopefully I won't make any mistakes here. But it's always a pleasure to share words of Torah with a very special colleague and somebody who has influenced my own son and is doing unbelievable work for transforming the college education of all of our children. The topic for tonight is the issue of my egg, my husband, her womb, whose child. And I want to thank Danny and Zelda for arranging with the New York Times to basically orchestrate that the past issue was focusing totally on our topic. And I also want to thank them for not focusing on the halachic aspects, but just dealing with the existential but very personal, emotional tension that goes on with these issues. And we're going to deal with this issue, which really can be dealt with in a whole host of ways. Danny mentioned that I had the opportunity to teach the rabbis who are already in their various pulpits. And so I gave a class on these issues for around 3.5 hours with around 100 pages of Makorot. As you can see, there are not 100 pages of Makorot, and we will not be here for 3 hours. And so we're going to do this in a very concise way, to the point that I'm reminded of a story of a rabbi who is traveling on a flight, and he is sitting next to somebody, and as sometimes rabbis do, they engage in conversations with the people around them. Do I need this? Do I need this microphone? What? Yes. Okay. So what happens is that rabbi is traveling. He's sitting next to this individual. He starts talking to him, and the individual says, "Listen, what do you do, Rabbi?" He starts to explain to him all the training he went through and everything else, and the person says to him, "You know, I'm Jewish. I really don't know that much about Judaism, but I understand that everything that you studied for all those years can be summed up in one statement, love thy neighbor as you love yourself." The rabbi looks at him and is a little disappointed because, you know, v'ahavta l'recha kamocha is a very important statement, but it really doesn't, you know, he's gone through Yeridea, he's gone through Choshen Mishpat, Hilcha Shabbos. Love thy neighbor as you love thyself seems to be a little bit of a stretch of what he represents. You know, he's done so much more than that. He turns to the person and goes, "And what do you do?" He goes, you have no clue what I do, Rabbi. You don't really understand. I have two PhDs, one from MIT, one from Harvard, and I'm an astrophysicist. And the rabbi says to him, you're right, I really don't understand what you really do. I understand you have two PhDs, but I understand that everything that you do, everything that you've studied, all those years of research, can be summed up in one phrase, twinkle, twinkle, little star. And the truth is that I feel that we're doing the same thing here tonight. I think that we're doing the twinkle, twinkle, little star version of a very important topic, of the issues of reproductive technology as seen through the prism of Jewish law. So let's open our Makorot, let's open our sources, and let's begin to discuss this issue. So the issue begins with an important understanding that God did not create us as perfect human beings. God did not create us as individuals and the whole world that's perfect, but rather gave us the gift of science to be God's partners within the world. That is highlighted in a very famous Midrash, where the Midrash says, we'll only read just a few lines of it, you know, if circumcision is so precious, why was it not given to Adam? And then it goes on further, and he says, well, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted us circumcised, why didn't he do it himself? And it goes on further, and it answers basically that HaKadosh Baruch Hu recognized the fact that he created the world, but the final component of creation is up to us. We circumcise our children. It's our responsibility to take the wheat and make it eventually into food. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not create the world perfect. HaKadosh Baruch Hu began the creative process and gave it over to us to continue the creative process. And indeed, the Gemara in Baba Basra has a very interesting conversation between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Soloveitchik discussed this Gemara, and he gave it a very interesting philosophical overlay. There is this conversation between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva, where Turnus Rufus, the Roman governor of Judea, says to Rabbi Akiva, do you know why the Jewish people are condemned to Gehenna? Because they help the poor. And Turnus Rufus then continues to elaborate on that. Suppose an earthly king condemned his subject to be incarcerated and not to be given any food or drink. And then someone came in and snuck food or drink to that individual. Would not the king be upset at him? After all, the king incarcerated the subject, and you went and defied the king by giving him food or drink. And you, the Jewish people, are considered the servants of God. Kili b'nei Yisrael avadayhein. We are the servants of God. And so Turnus Rufus says, the same way that subject who the king said, cannot get any food, and if you violate that, the person should be punished also, you, by helping the poor, also deserve to be destroyed. And Rabbi Akiva said, suppose the king did the following. Suppose the king incarcerated his child and said no one should give his child food or drink. And then someone went and gave the child food or drink. Would not the king be happy? And we are considered also the children of God. We are considered the children of God. And therefore, said Rabbi Akiva, we are rewarded for helping the poor. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, what is this difference between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus? Turnus Rufus suggests that we should wear the eyeglasses of God. God decided that this person should be poor. We have no right to change it. God decided that this person should be ill. We have no right to do something to change that situation. God decided that this couple cannot have children. We have no right to do something to change the status quo. Says Rabbi Akiva, we do not wear the glasses of God. We do not ask the question of why difficult things happen to good people. We don't have the answer to that question. But our challenge is that when certain things happen to good people, our responsibility is to seize the moment and to be partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to try to be able to change the status quo. That's the difference between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus. It's a different philosophical paradigm of how we approach the world. And that's exactly what the whole notion of reproductive technology is from a halachic perspective. We embrace the capacity
We don't demand. We embrace the capacity for a couple that wishes to actualize the dream of having a family to be able to do so. Yes, there are challenges. What is the status of the child? What types of procedures can be used? What is the priorities of the procedures that can be used? How do we follow those protocols? And we'll get into a few of them. But the first point to recognize is a philosophical point, and that is that we embrace the gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given to us, known as science, and to recognize that that gift represents the capacity for humankind to collaborate with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the ability to continue the creative process of the world. Indeed, the Meiri, in the third source of our handout, Meiri, who lived from 1249 to 1306, actually makes this unbelievable, wonderful statement, which one might suggest deals with reproductive technology, although it is pre the New York Times article of last week. And that is, the Meiri says the following: Kol shehu nase b'pula tivit einu b'klal kishafim. One should recognize that anything that is done through a natural way is not considered magic, which is forbidden from a halachic perspective. Afilu yedu livroa briut yafot shelob mizvug hamin. Even when there will come a time in which we'll learn how to create human beings, not through the natural act of intimacy. Kemosha noda b'sifri hateva, as is known through the Kabbalistic works, she'ein hadavar nimna, that this is not impossible, that there will come a time in which a human being will be able to be created not through the natural sexual act. And indeed, IVF, in vitro fertilization, represents that idea. And just a fast two-line summary, in vitro fertilization is the following. What happens is that the man's sperm is expressed, the male gametes are expressed, they are properly treated, and then the female gametes, the eggs, are also harvested. We don't just harvest one, we harvest many. And then what happens is there is a form of fertilization that happens within the lab, where the sperm is placed in an appropriate medium with an egg. The sperm attacks the egg. Only one sperm can penetrate the egg. And eventually that egg develops. And in the blastocyst stage of development, like 4 or 5 days into the development, that egg is then returned into the womb of the woman, or most of the time many eggs are returned into the womb of the woman, depending how old she is, but depending on a few other physiological issues. Or there is what's called ICSI IVF, and ICSI IVF does not even allow the opportunity for several sperm to attack the egg, but rather one sperm is set up in a way in which by using some type of pipette, It is totally introduced to the egg. It penetrates the shell of the egg to cause immediate fertilization. And again, one checks then the eggs that are developed, and then the ones that one feels are the best are then returned to the womb of the woman. So the Meiri is telling us that even when there comes a time in the development of humankind, in the development of science, where science will allow us to create human beings, not through the natural act of intimacy, as is known within the books of Sifri, Rishayim Lasot, it's permitted to do, Shekol Shehu Tivi, anything that uses science, Enu B'Klal Kishuf, is not considered magic. V'domo L'Ze Amru, and this is what it means, Kol She'esh Bo Mishum Refua, anytime science is used as a conduit to do progressive things, Ein Bo Mishum Darkei Amori, that is not considered a form of witchcraft which is prohibited from the Torah. So here we see almost a license from the Meiri in the 1200s dealing with an issue perhaps of this nature. Now it's important to recognize that there are risks in doing IVF. The woman who goes through IVF needs to go through certain hormonal treatments. These hormonal treatments are intense. There is new technology now that is actually reducing the amount of treatments so that the eggs can be removed actually at a stage in which they're not fully developed, and then they are developed outside of the ovaries. But the bottom line is that there is risks, and no couple is halachically mandated to go through these extraordinary measures. We see this idea actually in the Gemara, the Tosfos Pesachim, where if a person needs some type of risky operation in order to be able to be circumcised, halacha does not demand that that person go through that operation in order to be able to eat from the Karban Pesach, from the Paschal sacrifice. Just because one is only obligated to follow the norm. And that, if there are some challenges, for example, if one's siblings have died due to circumcision, one does not need to go through a risky operation to be able to be circumcised to be able to eat the Karban Pesach. Halacha does not require heroic activities in order to be able to perform positive commandments. I find it interesting that when the Gemara discusses that after 120 years that we are faced HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it asks us a whole bunch of questions. It asks us the question, for example, Sepita LeYeshua, have we anticipated the redemption? So people from Highland Park can say, yes, we incubated, no pun intended, Josh Fass. So we can say that. But the bottom line is, it asks you if you set up times to learn, were you appropriate in your business deals? And then it says, Asakta Bapiria Verivya. Mistranslated by most translations as, did you fulfill the mitzvah of procreation? But if you look at the word, it's not a kiyamta. It's not, did you fulfill the mitzvah? It's Asakta. Did you work at it? Halacha does not demand that one fulfill the mitzvah of Puravu. Halacha demands that you try to fulfill the mitzvah. There are some mitzvot that are not fully in our grasp, whether we fulfill them or not. If I'm a Yisrael, from today till tomorrow, I might want to be able to do. I might want to do Nesias Kapayim. I might want to do Duchani. The bottom line is, it's not within my grasp to be able to do that. And the same thing is true in this situation. If I cannot have children, halacha does not demand of me to do heroic activities, which includes reproductive technology. It allows me to do so. It welcomes the husband and wife to be able to do so, to actualize the dream of having a family. But what's important to recognize is that it is not a mandated requirement, but rather the use of science is welcome in order for us to be able to achieve our interest in having a family. With that in mind, I now would like to look at the sources that deal with the issue of having a family. And let's discuss the notion of what defines fatherhood. What defines one who's a father? If you don't mind, I'm going to just move around a little bit here. I'll make sure my voice is loud enough. But just it's a little late here, so I'll just move around a little bit. And that is, what defines the definition of paternity? So if we look at our sources, everyone have this, the second page, source number 5, where we begin by the story of Megillas Esther. It speaks about Esther. What does it say about her? Ki ein la av ve'ein. She has no parents. Va'anara yifas toar. She's pretty. Ubamos of the other ima. Her father and mother die. So the Gemara immediately asks the question. It's redundant. Why does the pasuk have to say twice that she has no parents? Doesn't need to repeat it. So the Gemara says that the pasuk's trying to accentuate an idea. And that is that when her mother became pregnant with her, the father died. The father was never alive for helping to raise the child. And when she was born, her mother died. So in other words, her mother gave birth to her, but also didn't raise her. So the first thing that we see here is Rashi again articulates that the father is called the father even if he doesn't raise the child, but simply being the donor of the sperm, or simply having the sexual act and being the donor of the sperm, defines fatherhood. This idea is fully developed a little bit more in the Gemara and Chagiga. Now keep in mind that it's important to recognize that the Gemara many times is not interested in the scientific truths, but more interested in paradigms in order to be able to define important definitions. So the Gemara asks the following. We know a Kohen Gadol cannot marry a woman who's been previously married. A Kohen can marry a woman who lost her husband. Can't marry a woman who's been divorced, but a woman who lost her husband. But a high priest, a Kohen Gadol, cannot marry anyone who's been married before. So the Gemara asks the question, can a Kohen Gadol marry a virgin who's pregnant? That's the Gemara's question. It's from our tradition, it's not another religion. Okay? That's what the Gemara asks. Okay? May the high priest marry a virgin who's become pregnant. So Shmuel perhaps says that maybe one can have certain types of sexual penetrations without causing bleeding, thus thinking that the woman is still a virgin even though she's had relations with another man. The Gemara disagrees with that. The Gemara says it is possible for a Kohen Gadol to marry a Besula, a woman who's never had relations and she's still pregnant, because she may have conceived in a bath. That there's a public bath, there was sperm left over in the bath, and she conceived through the sperm entering into her. Now again, we're not talking about biological truths here. We're talking about paradigms of definitions, important things. And the definition of a Kohen Gadol not marrying a woman is the fact that she's never had intimacy with a man, not that she's not been pregnant. So there is this notion called IUI, intrauterine insemination. IUI is a procedure that's not nearly as aggressive as IVF. And simply what happens is, sometimes a husband and wife are having difficulty having children for a host of different reasons. Sometimes it could be the pH factors within the vaginal area of the woman. It could be the limited amount of sperm, morphology of the sperm, etc., of the man. And you can sometimes deal with that issue by simply using IUI. What IUI does is basically it parks the sperm by the entrance into the fallopian tube. And by doing that, essentially, the sperm does not have to travel all the way to the fallopian tube. There's a whole bunch of, the way I explain it to the rabbinical students is that the sperm has to travel on the FDR drive with a tremendous amount of potholes along the way until it reaches its destination. So perhaps you create a flyover, as you have by Aventura, by I-95 there, and basically create a situation where you bypass all the potholes and you park the sperm in the entrance of the fallopian tube. So in the halakhic case, if a woman went through what's called an IUI, she would still be able to marry a Kohen Gadol because she had not had intimacy with a man. What is the status, by the way, of a person, of this child? What is the status of a child in which there was no relationship between the man and the woman? There's just a sperm donor divorced from any relationship. In the case of Mordechai, he has a in the case of Esther, the parents have a relationship. What about here? So Rav Shmuel Fivus and the Beis Shmuel suggest the following. Kasa b'chelkas v'cholkek. It's source number 9. Is everyone with me? Everyone with me? Okay, we're trying to understand the definitions of paternity. Kasa b'chelkas v'cholkek. The chelkas v'cholkek writes. The chelkas v'cholkek writes. Yesh l'stapek. He's concerned. He's not sure. Isha shenitra ba'ambati. Im ha'av kayem puravu v'im nikra b'no'ol ha'davar. If a woman becomes pregnant from a man's sperm in a bathhouse, namely without any form of intimacy, is the father connected to this child or not? However, says the Beit Shmuel, that it's clear to him that it is the child, l'chol davar. Rav Shmuel Fivus says that as long as the guy is the donor of the sperm, that is enough to be yotzei, to fulfill the obligation of puru revu. That is enough that the child is considered his child, the chol davar. If God forbid the father passes away, or when the father passes away, you'd say kaddish for the father. This idea is further concretized in a few places. Source number 10, the Tashbates. Where the Tashbates in the 1300s agrees with this halacha and suggests also that a simple sperm donor is considered halachically the father of the child. We're not going to go into that one as much. We're going to quote in the next source, on the next page, source number 11. And that is the Minchas Yitzchak. The Minchas Yitzchak was in charge of a modern Orthodox community known as Mea Shearim. Okay? He was the head of the Eda Haredis. I figured we'll find somebody who's beyond reproach. And the Minchas Yitzchak says the following. The Minchas Yitzchak writes that one of a person that gives, that has a sperm donation, he himself, he donates the sperm, but that's the way they use, let's say, IUI, intrauterine insemination. He says, Pshita li dekaima mitzvah. He's definitely fulfilled the mitzvah. And since he's worked very hard, it's not an easy procedure, and the child wasn't born on its own, the child had a male gamete donor, the husband. Therefore, he says, Benohu l'chol davar, it's his child according to everything. He's just worried about one thing, an important halakhic issue, and that is that when sperm donations happen, you need to make sure that there is some type of mashkiach in order to ensure that we don't make a mistake on who the father is. Now, there have been many cases in which, when there hasn't been oversight, that sometimes you've had situations, again, with the laboratories that are not interested in doing anything inappropriate. There have been a whole bunch of situations where laboratories have done inappropriate things. I'm not getting into those. Laboratories who have not interested in doing anything inappropriate, but sometimes in the interest of expediting things, there isn't the appropriate checks and balances. And so the Minchas Yitzchak demands that there be an extra set of eyes that is familiar with the process that makes sure that no other sperm is being used. Most labs will only work on one client at a time. The Minchas Yitzchak demands that there be a form of a mashkiach. In many of the places throughout New York now, Cornell, Maimonides, and a whole bunch of other places have the capacity to have hashkacha. South Florida has a situation now that it has the capacity to have hashkacha. All throughout Eretz Yisrael, there's the capacity to have hashkacha. That's no longer such a big, complicated issue anymore as it was perhaps in the 1980s when he discussed it. But the bottom line is, for our conversation, the definition of the donor, the definition of the father is simply the sperm donor. That is highlighted also in sources on the next page. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach agrees with this, and so does Rav Moshe Feinstein. So much so that Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe Feinstein both say the following. Let's say the husband does not have any sperm. You've done all the tests, you've done everything. Now, I'm not going to go through all the different tests, fine needle aspiration, and everything else that can be done. But let's say at the end, the husband has no sperm. But they want to have a family, and they want a sperm donor. So Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman both say they can only use a non-Jew as a sperm donor. Why? Because they don't want to create a situation of Shema Yisa Baso Choso. They don't want to create a situation in which that if you have a Jew that that donates the sperm, you could have a situation where you have multiple children that are born, and they're halachic siblings from the father, and you won't know who they are. So it's better to use non-Jewish sperm. The definition of who of the child being Jewish or not is not defined by the father, it's defined by the mother. And therefore, Rav Moshe demands that non-Jewish sperm can only be used, and Rav Shlomo Zalman says the same thing. Interesting enough, Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote his tshuva in Noam. How many people have ever read Noam before? Okay. And Rav Moshe wrote his tshuvas in the Igros Moshe. How many people have looked at the Igros Moshe before? Okay, a few more people than Noam. Rav Moshe's house was firebombed for this tshuva. Nothing happened to Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Shlomo Zalman's tshuva is around 20 pages. Rav Moshe's tshuva is maybe a half a page, but it's where you publish it. Rav Moshe's tshuva was very much publicized because it was published in something that a lot of people read. Rav Shlomo Zalman was published in a very obscure periodical that, again, by a show of hands, no one had ever read before. It was probably most people had never even heard of before. It's interesting. But they both demand that when a sperm donor uses, when you need a sperm donor, you use non-Jewish sperm. Let me throw an interesting issue to you. We're not going to deal with this issue, but I want to throw it out anyways. There is a new procedure, it's not so new, but it's new compared to what we've been discussing, called PGD, pre-implementation genetic diagnosis. After you do the IVF procedure, after you do the in vitro fertilization, you can do the following. At the blastocyst stage of development, when the fertilized egg is like 4 to 6 cells, you can go in there and take out a cell from the fertilized egg. It will continue to develop. It won't even know that that cell is missing. It's like, you know, a family that has many children, right? Whatever, you don't even know that cell is missing. And what happens is that that cell, you start doing tests on that cell. You can decide, you can see whether this whether the child's going to be male or female. You can decide if there are any genetic anomalies, Tay-Sachs, other challenges. You can even know things like the color of the hair, etc., etc., etc. Are you allowed to decide that you only want a female child and not a male child? Why? Let's say the following case, and this is a true case. I was actually asked about this on Israeli television and learned from my rabbinic career how to answer without answering the question. And the basic question was like this. It's a case, it's a true case. And again, I don't want to be stereotypical. I'm just giving the case because this is a true case. It happened in Beker Kolam Hospital, which is right outside Mei Shaarim, which has an unbelievable IVF clinic for obvious reasons. And what happened was that this was a couple from Mei Shaarim, and the couple could not have children. They agreed to get a sperm donor using Rav Shlomo Zalman. They used a non-Jewish sperm. The husband is a Kohen. He only wants female children because at the bar mitzvah time, he doesn't want a situation where the kid, he's a Yisrael. He's not a Kohen. Non-Jewish sperm defines paternity. He's a Yisrael. So what's going to happen at the bar mitzvah? At the bar mitzvah, the kid, okay, he'll get maftir the first time. It's good. But then the next time he gets an aliyah, right, he might not get maftir. They're going to want him Kohen. He can't get Kohen. So he says, all I want is female children, right? To the best of my knowledge, there's no women prayer services there. He only has to deal with the fact that he just wants a female child. Can you do PGD, this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, to decide whether you want male or female children? Can you do PGD because you want to be Makai in the mitzvah of Peruvu? You only have male children, you want a female child. Can you do PGD because of genetic challenges? A couple that are Tay-Sachs carriers and they've had certain challenges. And for example, there have been times where labs have made mistakes. There's a recent case in which a couple went through all of the testings, and what happened was the lab made a mistake and now they have a child who is Tay-Sachs. The next child they have, they most probably will try to do this form of PGD to make sure that they do not continue to have children that carry the challenge of Tay-Sachs. It's much better than having the question of whether you can abort a Tay-Sachs baby. There, other than the Tzitz Eliezer, no one permits the aborting of a Tay-Sachs baby, but Moshe Feinstein is ferocious against the Tzitz Eliezer. With the Tzitz Eliezer's permission, but he was ferocious against the Tzitz Eliezer on that issue. So the bottom line here is, what I'm trying to show you is, this definition of paternity is very important. And you deal with a whole bunch of different issues when it comes to paternity, when you discuss the issue, for example, of PGD, which is a whole different conversation. But the bottom line here is that the definition of paternity is a sperm donor. Let me bring you one other issue that I want to discuss a little bit. Let me just finish the point, and then I'm going to take questions, and then we're going to move the definition of the mother, which is much harder than the definition of the father. Okay? So just bear with me for one moment. A person goes to war. And before he goes to war, they've taken some sperm of his and they have frozen the sperm. Tragically, that person passes away. And the wife, who has no children yet, decides that she wants to remember her heroic husband by taking the frozen sperm and being impregnated with that sperm. So now she has a child. Now, everything we've talked about till now, at the point of conception, the sperm donor has been alive. Now you have a situation of posthumous paternity. The sperm donor is dead, right? The sperm donor could be dead 100 years. All right, you can preserve sperm for many, many years. What is the status of that child? Is that child connected to the father who's a sperm donor who's been dead for 50 years, 20 years, 10 years, or 5 minutes? And by the way, you can extract sperm after a person has passed away. That probably is not considered nivel hames, so it can be done in a whole bunch of different ways. So what's the status? So the Noda B'Yehuda in the 1700s asked the following question. We have this halacha called Yibum or Chalitza. Yibum requires that if a woman loses her husband and has no children, she has to go through this process of Chalitza. And the halacha is you have to wait 90 days to make sure that she's not pregnant. The Noda B'Yehuda asked the question, why do you have to wait 90 days? You should really wait 93. How does he get that? He says, suppose the following thing happens. Right before the husband passed away, they had relations. It takes 3 days, according to the Gemara, which also science suggests, takes 3 days sometimes for the sperm to hit the fallopian tubes. And therefore, you have 3 days plus the 3 months. You should wait 93 days, not 90. 90% of the Haronim say it's a rounding thing, right? You do 90, it's a rounding thing, and that's it. Give us a break. The Noda B'Yehuda doesn't say that. The Noda B'Yehuda says in the next source, on source number 13, he says an unbelievable thing. He makes a deal from the Pasuk that it says the following. It says the Noda B'Yehuda, that since the Pasuk says that at the point in time in which the husband died, ubein ein lo bishas misa, since at the point of death, even if she will become pregnant 3 days later after the husband died, she needs to go through the process of yibum l'chalitza. The reason why it's 90 days and not 93 days is because if she becomes pregnant after the death, even if it's 3 days or 24 hours afterwards, the Pasuk says, ubein ein lo, the moment in which the husband died, she has no child at that moment. She is a begeder. She's within the category of Yibum L'chalitza. But then the Noda B'Yehuda said something, why I brought this down, and I'm not trying to confuse you at 9:15 or so at night. The Noda B'Yehuda says, however, even though she is a bas yibum, because the fertilization happened after death, it is his child. It is the deceased child, l'chol davar. There is something called posthumous paternity, says the Noda B'Yehuda in the 1700s. Now there are those who suggest, that's nice, the Noda B'Yehuda says that, but the act of intimacy happened while he was still alive. Perhaps that's different than the case I gave you. But the bottom line is, from the Noda B'Yehuda's perspective, perhaps, and we're at the cutting edge of these issues, these are issues being discussed now, you could have a situation where a person dies 20 years earlier, and then he has a child. He can have a child 20 years after his death that has to say Kaddish, that has a halachic connection to the inheritance of that child, of that father. So that father could have 5 children when he's alive, sperm impregnate his wife 20 years later, and they would have to give him, this new child, a piece of the inheritance. This is posthumous paternity, according to the Noda B'Yehuda, although many poskim, again, suggest that this opens a petah that a 16-wheeler can drive through, a truck that a 16, you know, it's a hole that a 16-wheeler can drive through. But the bottom line is, I'm trying to show you how diverse this issue is, how significant this issue is, that posthumous paternity, which is a clear issue that can be deal with in our day and age, can be paternity according to a sheet of the Noda B'Yehuda. So to summarize, and then I'll take questions, and then we're going to move to the definition of maternity. It is clear that the definition of a father is simply the sperm donor. Even without any type of sexual intimate act, the simple donation of sperm defines paternity. We've seen that by the story that is found in Rav Shmuel Feivish, based on the Gemara. We've seen that concretized in the tshuvas that I've showed you. We've seen it concretized by Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman, who demanded that since paternity is defined by the sperm donor, that you use non-Jewish sperm when the husband doesn't have sperm. We see it being discussed even by the Noda Behuda and others, and that seems everybody holds that the definition of paternity is simply the sperm donor. Questions? What? You sure? Yes. From one perspective, and I'll get to that perspective, but let me explain you what I mean. That the father who donated the sperm, that Esther, for example, would have a responsibility to say, well, the Vilna Gaon didn't at that point decide to say women should say Kaddish. But, you know, assuming that it was a male, right, and wanted to say Kaddish for the, for the deceased, you have a halakhic responsibility to say Kaddish on the yahrzeit of your parent. Your father is defined first as the sperm donor that helped you come into this world. That's number one. Furthermore, halakhas of kibud of the aim, you have a responsibility that to treat the sperm donor as your father. Now, we also say that someone who does the heroic act and the responsible act of raising a child is considered like the father also. But that's not to exclude the halakhic definition of paternity goes to the sperm donor. So if I adopt a child and I raise that child has the right, after 120 years, to sit Shiva for me, to say Kaddish for me, and things like that. He's not halakhically mandated to do so. He has the right to do so. Because I'm considered his Rebbe Muvak. I'm considered his teacher. His quintessential teacher. Because I raised the child. I paid for his education. Right? Which is no small thing anymore. So the bottom line is that's why halakhically he has that child has responsibility if he or she wants to. But the halakhic responsibility also goes to the sperm donor, even though you might say, and emotionally I understand that, it's unfair that that person has had nothing to do with the life of the child, but I think it's important to recognize from a halakhic perspective, and here the challenge is to define terms in halakhic terms, because it's important. It's in the same way it might sound not sensitive to give the sperm donor the definition of a father, it is critically important to know what that definition is in order to allow couples to actualize the dream of having a child. Because if the definition of fatherhood is the sperm donor, then that gives you a roadmap of how a couple in which the husband has no sperm can actualize the dream of having a child, namely using non-Jewish sperm. If you don't have that roadmap, then Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman cannot do the heroic activity that they do to achieve those goals. You can disagree or agree. I'm just trying to explain that. Clearly, from a halakhic perspective, and I've given you just a few makoros, you can email me, I'll give you another 50. On this, clearly that's the perspective. That does not take away from the adoptive parent and the responsibility to sit Shiva for that child, to respect that child, to respect that parent, and everything else of that nature. But it is important to recognize the definition of paternity is how I've shown you halakha defines it. Yes?
As the son of a non-Jewish sperm conduct himself, what is he? What tribe is he?
He's a Yisrael.
He's a Yisrael.
Right. He's a Yisrael.
He's a firstborn too.
Does he have a din of a bechor?
He wouldn't have a status. Would he have a status of a bechor?
That's a good question. I don't, off the top of my head, know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I don't see why not, but I don't know. Yes, we'll move.
In light of what you said about the Meiri, do you foresee people using this as a justification for cloning?
No, because that's not, cloning is not, cloning does not allow us to create, well, it depends. Cloning is not necessary in order to be able to create additional, to be able to create children. Cloning, it can be used for two ways. There's what we call therapeutic cloning. That cloning is again, we're not going to discuss that, but in one sentence, I think that is halakhically 100% permitted. Therapeutic cloning, which is there to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of a rapo yirape, but cloning that is done for any other reasons, I think is dangerous. It creates a system of two classes of human beings, and we have to stay away from it as far as we can. But the normal therapeutic cloning or stem cell research, which are really extensions of each other, time does not allow me to go through the nuances of that, and I think the halacha fully embraces that and fully wants us to be able to do so in order to be able to guarantee the health of humanity and society through those medical procedures. Yes?
Case of where the donor is non-Jew, it would seem that the child might be a bechor as far as Peter Rechem is concerned,
right.
But not be a bechor l'nachala.
Right.
Because
right. Because bechor, it depends on each issue of bechor can be maternal-centric or paternal-centric. You'd have to go through each one. In the nachla, it's paternal-centric, so clearly it wouldn't be part of it. But the Beter Rechem is probably maternal-centric, so it would be.
In addition, even though this child would be Yisrael, he would have no association with Sheva, because Sheva seems to be paternal-centric also.
After Emir Tashem, when Mashiach comes, we'll allow him, not from a Ruach HaKadosh perspective.
Like Ger in that respect. The Ger also is now formal Sheva.
100%, right. But to be welcomed into the Jewish community as anybody else. 100%. Yes, Rabbi.
My son was telling me he had been to a shiur by his Rosh Hashiva, Nachum Rabinovich, and this is all in his book that he just published recently, that somehow all the DNA really like gets erased or something, like it's considered erased within like the first initial period of time after these IVF babies or whatever are created, like these donor babies are created. So like his genetic material doesn't really matter.
I'm not sure that Rabinovich is a major posek, and I would never disagree with him. I've never read his material on this.
His shoe was low on the same topic.
His major issue, what Rabinovich deals with right now is, he has a major concern, and his major concern is that in Eretz Yisrael, many of the Rabban, not many, one or two major thinkers have made comments that he is ferociously against, and so has most of the poskim. And they've suggested that women who haven't gotten married by a certain age can use donor sperm to have children when they're still single. And he has gone ballistic on those issues because he said that what now happens is that instead of what you're doing is you're using science not to perpetuate the capacity to have families, but perpetuating the capacity for people not to be interested in the need to have couples raising a child, but rather having single women raising. Right. So his major issues right now, what he talks about all the time on this issue, is that I have never heard him speak.
This is a sheer debate. Boys,
right.
And was on this topic.
Right, so I don't know.
No, but he was talking all about this, and he was saying that the DNA is basically at the blueprint, but at some point during the reproductive cycle, when the cells are reproducing, that somehow when it's introduced into the back into the uterus, that the genetic material could possibly be erased.
So I'm not a doctor. Are there doctors here? I don't know, that's true.
I'm hearing you saying that it really doesn't matter who the donor is, because that's why you have to wait till the actual birth to see who your parent is. And so that I don't know, this is what he was saying. It's in his book.
I'll have to look at it, but I'm not familiar with it, nor does it. Again, I'd have to look at it.
Does that have some impact on like what the child's status is then, like whether the
I'm not familiar with it, nor do I fully understand it. So I have to really research it before I can answer you. I don't understand it. Definitely, I mean, my understanding of the science, and if there are doctors here, if I'm wrong, please let me know, is the genetics do not get erased. In fact, when we deal with maternal, which we're about to do, the challenge is that you can have a situation, as is described in the New York Times, where the donor egg really is the genetic makeup of the child, and the surrogate, the one who carries the child, will not have a genetic blueprint of the child, even though she will nurture the fetus. And there is the halakhic challenge when you can bifurcate the nurturing womb and the genetic blueprint. And that's why halakha will deal with the challenge between four different approaches. Rabbi.
So I understand that the procedure, the kind of Moshe and Shlomo Zalman, is to use goyim for the sperm. So there's not a problem with that. Also, the problem with possibly marrying the sister.
Right.
I'm just wondering, if, let's say someone is over on that and uses Jewish sperm. Would be the yichus of the child?
The yichus would go after the sperm donor. You'd have to try to see if you can normally, there's a certain anonymity there. Assuming you could break that anonymity, minimally you would want to know where the father was born, the date, which hospital, and where the location is. So that if they, when the child dates, at least they can ask what the birth date of the child, what your father is, and if that was the same, which city, and if that was the same, which hospital. So you would basically try to obviate the issues of semi-yisa bazakoso by creating this filter of many different levels. But Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman, in order to obviate the need for those various levels of filters, did what they did, and Rav Moshe did it at great personal risk. Okay. Yeah, please.
You said that I guess it's forbidden for single women to have a sperm donor so that they can have children without being
What I said was that Rabinovich and many other folks, Rabinovich and Bernstein and others, are ferociously against that for the reasons I just articulated.
But my question was saying for a man who decides he doesn't want to get married but he wants to have a child to find a surrogate egg and a surrogate mother.
From my perspective, the concern is that this is a situation then where science, which has the capacity to actualize a dream of a couple having a family, needs the overlay, and again, I'm speaking very subjectively here, needs the overlay of an ethical or concern about certain social issues. And when you allow the science to be used in a way in which all of a sudden single people could start having children, you run the risk of I think, creating a situation in which you destroy the nucleus of a family instead of empowering it. That's the concern, and I'm sure that there will be people who take me to task on that issue. But, you know, in a nutshell, I think that's the issue. Can I just ask you, it's getting late, and I really want to get to the meat of the issue, and that is the definition of maternity. I'll stay here as long as you want, but I'm not sure everybody else wants to stay here as long as I want. So let me just get to the maternity issues. What's the definition? How do we define a person? How do we define the mother of the child? So let's say you have two mothers. How could you have two mothers? In the way I just explained earlier when I explained IVF, if a woman cannot carry a fetus, she's had certain challenges, let's say she, God forbid, had a bout with cancer, and they removed eggs before she before she went through certain forms of therapy, and then basically she no longer has eggs, and she went through a certain procedure that no longer allows her to carry a child. So the question is, let's say she wants to have a child, or she has other challenges. I mean, I've been involved in certain cases where there's one couple who they had one child, then they had easily six or seven miscarriages. I mean, he has spoken about this publicly, so I don't mind mentioning his case. I won't mention his name. Until they used a surrogate, they used her egg, his sperm, and another woman carried the child. You create a situation where either you can donate the egg, the couple is married, either she can carry the child, she gets a donor egg, or she can donate the egg and somebody else carries the child. Or as in this case, where I believe it was the grandmother's body, she was the surrogate, and it was the daughter's egg. Okay? So...
That wasn't the article.
Oh, that wasn't?
No.
Okay.
They quoted that case.
Or, in any case, the bottom line is, in any case, that you have a situation in which you have two different women, and basically the maternity is split between the carrier and the donor. What is the halachic status of this child? So there's four different approaches. Okay, option one is that it's the genetic donor. Option two is it's the host mother. Option three is it's both. And option four is it's none. So there are poskim who say all of the above. There are poskim who say that it is none. There are poskim that say it is both. And there are poskim that say, the majority of them say it's either the genetic donor or it's the host mother. Let's look at the different approaches. So let's look at source 14. Source 14 actually happens to find itself in the conversations that we're having regarding the building of the tribes of Yaakov, the tribes of the Jewish people. And it's about the story of Rachel and Leah. The Targum Yonatan ben Uziel says that when Rachel, and you'll see that when Rachel and Leah are both pregnant with their last child, that Leah sees that Rachel is pregnant with Dinah, and that Leah is pregnant with Yosef. Well, no, I'm not making a mistake. Just trust me. So what happens is that Leah sees that she is pregnant with Yosef and that Rachel is pregnant with Dinah. And what she sees is going to happen is essentially that Rachel will have less tribes come from her than even the maidservants. So she prays to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for an inter-uterine exchange. That basically, that what should happen is that miraculously, the child in the womb of Rachel, namely Dinah, and the child in the womb of Leah, I told you I would take your idea and elaborate upon it, and the womb of Leah are changed, so that now Rachel is carrying Yosef, and Leah is carrying Dinah. That is the Targum Yonatan ben Uziel that you have in source 14, where I have underlined Ushmiya min kadam Hashem salusa de Rachel, the Leah, that Hashem listens to the prayer of Leah, v'hislapu ubrayu b'menehon, and there is a change of uterus of fetuses in the uterus, v'hava Yosef Yosef b'masa de Rachel, and Yosef miraculously is in the womb of Rachel. Vedina b'ma'asa d'Leah, and Dina is in the uterus of Leah. And so, there are those that suggest, for example, Rav Shaul Yisraeli on the next page, a major posek of the past, he suggests the following, that this proves the fact that the definition of motherhood is not the genetic donor, but rather the surrogate mother. Because The Targum Yonatan ben Uziel tells us that the genetic makeup of Yosef came from Leah, yet we never call Yosef the son of Leah. In fact, when I even said it, 90% of you were correctly so, means that you're still awake, wanted to correct me, right? And so what happens is, what's obvious according to Rav Shaul Yisraeli, is that the definition of maternity is not the genetics. The definition of maternity is the one who nurtures the fetus, namely Rachel. So the first time I gave this shiur, some of the Rosh Yeshivas of YU were in the audience. Rabbi Tendler says to me, shame on me that I use Haggadah to prove my point. I have more than enough other sources to prove the point. And my response, again, what Rabbi Tendler forgot, I'll never know, is that the only reason why I quote it is because Rav Shaul Yisraeli, a major posek in Eretz Yisrael, uses this as the basis. He was a Dayan in Yerushalayim. He was a major, major posek. Uses this as his definition of defining maternity, and therefore I quote it because of the source number 17, the letter that Rav Shaul Yisraeli writes, using this as his preeminent source. So if we move backwards in the sources, source 16, you have Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal says the following. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, in halacha, we define the fetus only starts to get the halachic status of a quasi-human being at 40 days. In fact, if you look at the development of the fetus at 40 days, you'll start to see different development that happens at 40 days. The quickening process, there's a certain development process. There's a heartbeat before 40 days, but the really developing process, pre-40 days, halacha does not consider the fetus even a quasi human being. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, you have to look at which mother is involved at the 41st day. At the 41st day, the genetic donor is no longer involved. She's gone, she's out of the picture. The only one that's involved is the surrogate, is the womb that is nurturing the fetus, and therefore that's the definition of motherhood, and that is not the genetic donor, but the surrogate mother. To the point in which the language that only Rav Aaron Soloveitchik could use, if you look at source number 16 and you count six lines from the top of his source, and you just look at the last few words, you'll see, we'll read, again, six lines from the top of his source. Skip the first word. She'ein li'yaches le'beitzit hanitremes. Do not connect yourself to the egg that has been donated. Yoter ma'asher kik'el chomer sinseti totzeret yapan. Look at it no different than a synthetic material as if it was made in Japan. In other words, do not treat the genetic donor as anything to do with the fetus, but rather the surrogate, the one who nurtures the fetus at the 40th day, and obviously earlier, as explained, the fertilized egg is returned at the blastocyst stage of development, which is not more than 6 or 7 days into the fetal development. So by the 40th day, what's happening is that it is the surrogate who defines the notion of maternity. Perhaps the more preeminent proof is found in the source right above it, the source 15. Source number 15 has the following comment, and that is the following. Source number 15 says that if you have a woman who's pregnant and she's not Jewish, she gives birth to her children, those children need to go to the mikvah like she does if she's converted after she gives birth to the children. However, what happens if the woman... What happens if the woman gives birth? What happens if the woman converts while she's pregnant? So the halacha is very interesting. Let's look at source number 15. twin brothers who were converts, and similarly if they were emancipated slaves, may neither participate in chalitza nor contract levirate marriage, nor are they guilty of a punishable offense for marrying a brother's wife. If, however, they were not conceived in holiness, in other words, twin brothers, if they go through conversions, ger kekatan shenu adami, they are not considered halachic relatives between each other. What happens if the following? They are conceived in holiness. They are not conceived in holiness. In other words, when they are conceived, the woman's not Jewish, but were born in holiness. In other words, at the point in which they're born, the woman has already converted. They neither participate in chalitza nor contract levirate marriage. In other words, they're not responsible for yibum between each other. Why? Because yibum is defined by the relationship of the father. And what happens is, at the moment of immersion, whatever relationships have been defined are cut. Now, when the woman is pregnant and she converts, any relationships that have been formalized are cut. The father has been defined the minute he gave sperm. So since the woman converts, any relationships that the fetuses have already developed, those are cut. However, says the Gemara, the Mishnah, but they're guilty of a punishable offense for marrying a brother's wife. That relationship is not defined by the father, that's defined by the mother. Says Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, this very, very difficult piece of Gemara proves to us that the relationship between the mother and the fetuses is not defined at the moment of donating the gamete, but rather during the nurturing process. And since the nurturing process is not over at the point in which the pregnant woman immerses, that relationship has not fully been established, and therefore, if the relationship has not yet been formalized, it is not severed. And therefore, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg uses this very elaborate proof to articulate the position that the definition, again, of the mother, that the definition of the mother is a surrogate, because here we see that a child, that a uterus that is converted, a fetus that is converted, in some ways the relationship with the father is compromised, but the relationship with the mother is not compromised, and therefore that's showing that the relationship with the mother is not fully developed during the nurturing process in utero. And therefore it's not the genetic donor that is defining the moment, because if that was the case, that relationship should be severed also. It is the nurturing that happens in the fetus that is really defining the moment. Now, if you turn to the next page, you'll see that there are others who disagree. Rav Kalav disagrees. The Eda Haredis based in, and actually Rav Gorin also defined the definition of maternity to be the donor of the gametes. This is probably the only time that Rav Gorin and the Eda Haredis find themselves on the same side. It's a good trivial question. However, Rav Yashiv was asked this question in source 20, and even though Rav Yashiv is not a fan of IVF, he says if it was done, then the definition of maternity is the surrogate and not the donor of the egg. However, since there is various poskim that say different things, there are some that say it is the donor of the gametes of the mother, and there are some that say that it is a surrogate. In my experience, and this is based on Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who says it's a surrogate, you have to be very concerned about the following issue. Everything that we're talking about is being discussed. Rabbi Kaufman will tell you this is all new stuff. This is not stuff that has been discussed for 30 years. It does not have a halakhic history to it yet. It's cutting edge. It's the issues that are happening in the here and now. Because of that, and keeping in mind the two majority approaches is either it's the donor of the egg or the surrogate mother, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg says the following. Even though I say the definition of maternity is the surrogate, he suggests you do conversion even if the donor of the egg is not Jewish. In other words, even though Rav Aaron Soloveitchik says, if the donor of the egg is not Jewish and the surrogate is Jewish, you don't have to do conversion. The only time you have to do conversion is if the surrogate is not Jewish, even if the donor of the egg is Jewish. Rav Zalman Nechemya says, I believe, based on that very complicated Gemara in Yevamos, that the definition of maternity is the surrogate. But because there are major poskim, major gedolim, who suggest that the definition of maternity is the egg donor, if either one of them are not Jewish, you should do geirus l'chumra. So in cases that I've been involved in, where the egg donor has been not Jewish, I will still make a I will still do a conversion without brachas, without anything. It has no downsides to it. It only has upsides. Because, let's say in 20 years from now, the posts can move, and they decide that the definition of maternity is the donor of the gamete. Let's say this, one second, let's say this girl, she can still marry a Kohen because it's a Geirus L'chumra. It's a decision that can be made afterwards. I anticipated that question. So the bottom line is that the Geirus does not make her Asa the Kahuna. Only if you need the Geirus does she become Asa Kahuna, and that will be decided by the Masada Kedushin, not by the rabbi at that moment in time. The Geirus L'chumra does nothing in any issues of Kahuna. So the bottom line is that let's say in 20 years from now, this young lady is not Shomer Shabbos. You can't really convert her. So you create a situation where, you excuse me for using these paradigms, I don't mean to be flippant. You could have OU babies, Huff K babies, and Star K babies. This one is only good according to this shita, this one's only good according to this shita, this is Yashan, this is Chadash, this is that. It's absurd. It can really create a situation of great schism within the Jewish community. And therefore, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, despite the fact that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and others suggest that you do not need to do conversions when the egg donor is not Jewish, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who intellectually says, I believe that the egg donor doesn't define maternity, says still do the conversions. And in the cases that I've been involved in, where the egg donor has not been Jewish, I still do a geirus. There's a special certificate that's written up. The certificate indicates the whole situation. It indicates why the conversion's been done. It's not the standard geirus certificate. But in 20 years from now, you don't know how the halachic majority is going to rule. And you do not want to classify. If the halachic majority rules that she needs the geirus, then the kahuna issue is an issue. But if the halakhic majority is still the way it is now, where there is a split that moves back and forth, there are some people that have said that Rav Yashiv has changed his mind on this issue also, since this written piece. So the bottom line is that you don't want to lock a person into whether they're Jewish or not Jewish based on what the contemporary thinking is, because this is too new. It's too new to do that, and therefore the suggestion is the way I articulate it. The bottom line is, and with this I conclude, and the bottom line is that this is a wonderful opportunity that science has given us. And we dare not distance ourselves from this issue because halacha doesn't know how to deal with it. Our poskim, our gedolim, have embraced this issue. They are aware of this issue. They have studied the science in the most rigorous of ways. They are familiar with the science. They have seen the procedures. They have been in the labs. They have done the research. They have gone through the material. Because halacha would, in order to celebrate the immortality and the eternality of Torah, you have to be able to use the paradigms of Torah to deal with contemporary issues. And here, halacha has been able to do so, not without its challenges, as it should be. This is not an easy journey, and we're still on the journey. We're not yet at the destination. But I just wanted to give you a twinkle, twinkle, little star insight into the journey, and to recognize that I have not by any chance quoted all the sources. I've just basically given you a very brief overview of the issue, and for you to understand the challenges of this issue, but to recognize that these scientific advancements are something that halacha encourages us when we wanted to take advantage of, and when we follow the roadmap that halacha has put down, it is possible to take advantage of these and to still do it in ways that is consistent with the norms and mores of halacha. Thank you very much. Yes, should I take a few more?
A lot of questions, but one would be, for instance, is there any downside to having a Jewish couple who wants to have a baby, she can't carry the duration of the pregnancy, so she gets a surrogate. But should she get a Jewish or non-Jewish surrogate?
So that's a great question. There's a difference of opinions of exactly who the surrogate should be. Should be Jewish or not Jewish? There's different shitas within the poskim.
Can the surrogate be married?
No. The surrogate should not be married. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who I have smicha from on these issues, has his own protocol. The Beis Din of the Eidah Haredes has slightly different protocols. Some suggest that it should be a non-married Jew first. Some suggest it should be a non-Jew first. There's different approaches based on different priorities. If anyone needs to deal with this issue, halacha l'maisa, they should ask their local Orthodox posek, and they'll give them direction of how to deal with this. But there's definitely difference of opinions, of priority of what we call trumat beit zit, or of the surrogate, and that really depends on a plethora of different issues that we, if you want to stay for now, an extra hour or so, we could definitely discuss. Yes?
You presented three reasons why the birth mother is to be considered the mother, either because based on Tarek Miyasim and Uziel, or the approach of Avraham Salvech, who said it's my child before 40 days, or based on Gemara and Yavamos.
Right.
You did not present any reasons why the donor woman should be considered the mother.
Because, okay, so if you read through Tchumim, the fifth volume, it has a whole bunch of reasons. I've quoted that in Source 19. But the basic thing is that the genetics is the koveya, is the establishment in the situation of the male. We've seen that in very clear terms, and therefore there's no reason why the genetics should not be the koveya when it comes to the female also. That's the normative approach that uses that as its thing. It's a very simple, perhaps the correct, I mean, sometimes the simplest approaches are the most...
It's disregarding all the halakhic precedents.
So they would say the Maya Ba'alma thing is great, but it has nothing to do with definitions of maternity. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg's approach, the case of Rachel and Leah, the Gadata, you can't use Haggadah to deal with halachic issues. You know, shame on you for even quoting it, as Rabbi Tendler would tell me. And the third approach about Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg is they do not accept that line in the sand as being able to take that, to borrow a phrase from Kierkegaard, that major leap of faith, to take that Gemara and Yavamis and to suggest that that can apply to the definitions of maternity. It never was there to use those definitions. We find the definitions based on a male is the gamete, and therefore you don't have a right to take this major leap to decide all of a sudden it's the surrogate. That's the sheet that's the sheet of Rav Gorin, that's the sheet of the Beis Din Eidah Haredes, that's the sheet of Rav Kalev. They have other makoros also. I don't remember them all off the top of my head, but those are that's the normative shot. They don't feel there's any chiddush in that. The definition of paternity and maternity is the gamete. Obviously, there's a sensitivity when someone adopts a child that also has to be put in there, but the surrogate is not the definition, according to them. Yes?
What are the logical implications of considering, you mentioned four possibilities, of considering both women the mother, considering either woman the mother, and what's the greatest?
The Tzitz Eliezer is the only one who says that they're both the mother. And therefore, the Tzitz Eliezer is not a fan of IVF. The concern is then how do you deal with all issues of yichus, of maternity, who they can marry to, and things of that nature. None being the mother has its own set of issues. But the Tzitz Eliezer is a minority of one, but he was one of the major poskim, so he shouldn't be ignored. the normative issues that we deal with in contemporary conversations in Psak is whether it is the genetic donor or the host mother. That's the normative. That's the major conversation amongst the poskim. And therefore, I concluded with the idea that we shouldn't throw one out the window to advocate for the other, but follow Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg's very wise comment that even though he advocates for one in the fifth volume of Tchumim, he suggests that we find a way to embrace both by doing Geirus L'Chumra. Yes?
If the host mother is halachically the mother of the child, and what if she changes her mind and doesn't want to give the baby back, then it seems to me that halachically she shouldn't have to because she's the mother, right?
So there's a whole bunch of different issues regarding that also, about who's the, you know, I'm not really familiar with that, so I can't really answer it. There's a whole bunch of also legal issues that are very complicated in this matter, and it varies state by state. Different states have different protocols for this. Again, I'm not totally familiar with them. But yeah, that's clearly an issue that needs to be part of this conversation. Let's start from the back, and then yes. All the way in the back. I'm sorry. Yes, please. What? Because they're saying that if you don't have both, then if you don't have the nurturing as well as the female gamete, that's not considered a mother. A mother has to be the way the protocols were established. There was never this bifurcation, and if there's this bifurcation, you know, therefore there's no complete mother, therefore there's no mother. It's not an approach that's really accepted in halacha, so I didn't really spend time developing it. The real two ones that I really developed is, as I said, is that the genetic donor or the surrogate, and therefore I think it's important that we spend the time recognizing that's where the halachic tension is at this point in time. Yeah, yes, all the way in the back, yes. Right. Father's a Kohen, surrogate, I would assume, depending on your approach, I would assume the answer is still yes, because what would be the reason why you wouldn't? Because you cannot have. I'm not sure. No. The kid. Oh, if the definition of a surrogate, if the definition of a surrogate is the mother. So right, the kid's not Jewish. So then the kid obviously becomes a ger. He becomes the Yisrael, and that's it. If you define the definition of maternity to be the gamete, so as long as the egg comes from a Jew, so then it's important to recognize that there's no mamzerus issues, because mamzerus, even if you used a married, which no one really permits, because mamzerus requires there to be an act of intimacy. And if there's no act of intimacy, then really mamzerus is not an issue. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach deals with that issue in some great detail in Noam Aleph, in that very long tshuva that he has. What? Yes, Rabbi Greenman. My chaver who sang underneath my chuppah. I have to tell you that I was thinking about going out with my wife in my single days, and Larry told me to go out with my wife, and he said, I think I said to him, well, if I go out with her, we get married, you have to sing underneath my chuppah. And, right, Larry, isn't that what happened? Okay. Yes. Right.
She remarried, and that man becomes the adopted father, or the father. Well, he's really adopted. It's such an anomaly.
Well, even more than that, if she doesn't have any other children, and the husband passes away, according to that shita, she'd have to go through chalitza. Well, that's why the shita that says that the definition of egg donor is mother, because you say, why should there should be a little plug? The same way for males is that way, same way with female. The other shita is that in the case of male, there's no nurturing process. So as a child should be defined by the parent that nurtures. So in the case of a male, and I'm not going to touch this any further regarding the role of fathers, but in the case of a male where there's no nurturing process, so maybe it's just genetics, but in the case of the mother where there's a nurturing process in the fetal development, that should be considered. Yeah, you're 100% right. That's the challenge, and that's why Rav Zalman Nechemya says that therefore he suggests that there should be gerus in source 18, even though he holds that it's the definition is a surrogate. He's not willing to dismiss those who say it's the gamete. The gamete is the definition, and therefore he says you shouldn't take the chance. Yes. Right. Right. These are the issues. I mean, there's a whole bunch of literature being discussing these issues. For example, the next issue is what happens if you can, if a woman is pregnant and she's less than 40 and she's carrying less than 40 days, assuming that we can totally calibrate that, but she's carrying less than 40 days. So the halacha is you violate the Shabbos. It's considered maya ba'alma, like a sack of water. So the sheet of the Ramban quoting the Bahag says, mutar l'chalal Shabbos achas, it's permitted to violate one Shabbos in order to allow this fetus to celebrate many Shabbatot in the future, even though it's not yet a quasi human being. What about if the fertilized egg is in the freezer in the lab, and the lab has a blackout, and the eggs are thawing out? There's no backup systems, which doesn't really happen, no backup systems. Can the embryologist, can the lab technician drive over and save these fertilized eggs? So all the shitas say no, because the whole permission of being able to do it less than 40 days is when it's in the womb, and it has the potential to grow into a fetus. But since the lab, it does not have the potential to grow into a fetus, you cannot permit the violation of Shabbos. But what happens when the lab becomes an environment in which it can develop into a fetus? So then halacha wouldn't change, but the scientific protocols change, and then it would be permitted to drive over to the lab and to save the fertilized eggs. But in our day and age, at this point in time, driving over there, doing a biblical thing, would be a violation of the Shabbos. That's what's written by, you know, 10 different poskim and a whole bunch of different literature that we did not discuss here today. But it is important to the issue of stem cell research. Yes?
Just a couple of questions. First of all, in source 18, the Mizamna Shigalva refers to Rabbi Akiva Eger plus the Nasivas.
Right.
Which you didn't elaborate on.
Right.
What is he referring
to? So you have to look at Tchum Krahe. I just gave you one, what I consider to be the major argument of Rav Zalman Nechemya, again, is that
his argument says to be machmer because of Svaras and Asivas.
Right. So look at the Chumen Krache. Next time you come to YU, go to the library and just make a photocopy.
Second of all, I'm not quite sure what the legalities of
by the whole Krache is all on this issue. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what the state legalities have to do with this. If the halacha is that the one woman is the mother, the other is the mother. I mean, it's not, I don't think you apply Dinah Sedina to that. It's
right now, when it's in conflict to the right. So, I'm saying I'm not sure that I understand these issues well enough on that issue. So,
and the third question was, in the source that you actually give, it seems that Rav Waldenberg was saying that he says Hayalav Mishyachis Acharish Hamoligasa, where he seems to agree also that the surrogate mother is the mother. He doesn't seem to say that both women are
share
motherhood, if you will.
Where does he say that?
It's in the second paragraph.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Halfway down. It says,
okay, so I'm telling you, in this Chuvas, he writes that they're both.
Okay, because it seems that the idea changed his mind here, or that yeah. to follow this opinion or what?
Right. In his tshuvas, he writes it's both.
Maybe he's a poser, but that's why I asked.
Yeah. Yes. So, again, so there's different approaches to that. Some suggest that it should be a non-Jew. Some suggest that it should be a Jew because of the conversion issue. And there, different poskim would say different things. Some would advocate one over the other. Some would say that it's better that the egg donor be from a single woman who's Jewish. What? Why can't you do it? Egg donor. Egg donor. I said a married woman. But a single woman, they suggested why. So then how do you deal with the same problem of Shema Yisa Basucho? So you deal with it the way I told the rabbi to deal with it. That is, you ask for the name. You don't even have to ask for the name. The date of birth, the hospital, and the city. And you deal with it that way. Very complicated. Not easy stuff. Not easy stuff. But this is that we have. Yes. So in the situations that I've been involved in, they keep it very private. Some have and some haven't. It's the prerogative of the parents. Some have used this as a way of being able to help others in a very public way. We had a medical ethics conference on this issue 2 years ago, and one of the couples that went through this agreed to speak publicly on the issue with Dr. Pelkowitz about the mental challenges, the psychological challenges to go through this. And he volunteered. And PBS just interviewed me on this issue over the phone and asked me if I know somebody who would... And he and his wife have no problems with doing this. That's their decision. But really, the only people you have to have this conversation with... for example, let's say you're worried about Geirus. So in my conversations with Rav Schechter on this, he suggested that you don't have... You do the bris on the eighth day... You don't even make the conversion, you don't make the bracha for the conversion bracha, you make the standard brachas, like you would do a regular bris, and you just have three people watching the maisa bris. You're basically the rabbi, the moel, and you pull one other, person in there, and it basically keeps between them, and you do the standard brachas, you don't do the conversion brachas, because the maisa bris is what's ma'akev, not the brachas. So that you keep that quiet. And that's in Boca Raton Synagogue, in the situations that's happened, that's exactly the way we did it. It was the assistant rabbi, myself, and the Moel, and a special document was written for the parents to keep, and when the child gets married, as I am getting involved with YU Connects and the Shidduch world, that seems to be the easiest issue with marrying off children right now. And the other piece, for example, is it has to be done. It can be done, with a certain amount of quietness. And I don't think, again, I'm saying this anecdotally. I don't think yet we've hit the time in which most of these children are of marriageable age yet. I think that will happen in the next 10 years or so, and then you'll start to see some of these issues being dealt with. But for example, protocols and policies for schools to define definitions of Jewish children, that has already happened. And I have, the Rosh Yeshivas and YU have been involved with many schools creating protocols on these issues in order to accommodate this additional level, which often has to be dealt with. Yes? No. I have not. I'm sure that happens, but I have not. Two more questions, and then...
Could you explain, from the citation from Chumen, where Rav Kalev seems to say that the only time that the donor mother counts is where one is Jewish and the other is not Jewish. But he said if they're both Jewish, then the surrogate mother. You go after the surrogate mother after all. And I don't understand the logic of that.
So I think what Rav Kalev is basically saying is, at the end of the day, he defines maternity, and you have to read the whole piece. He defines maternity as if it is the egg donor. He's saying that, you know, he's an advocate that both of them should be Jewish. As I mentioned when the question was asked, there's different approaches about that. He's an advocate that they should both be Jewish. And therefore what he says is that it should be better that they're both Jewish. But if they're not both Jewish, what determines is if the Beit Sidon Mufarit Shogaya, even if it's put in the womb of a woman.
Because the first person says, let us see Em HaYal Kasher Shneem Yudin.
Right.
So then he seems to say that the surrogate mother is the one who's the mother. As long as they're both Jewish.
No, but he says, Avo Beit Sidon Mufarit Shogaya, Shishtav
Rechim. It's only if they're split.
So you have to read his whole thing. There's just a whole bunch of shitas that say the definition is the gametes. Okay, last question. Yes. Please.
I actually have two questions, so let's see if I can get both
of them. Go for
one
it.
Is,
just make it as one question. Ask Dean Surowitz. He normally gets the, can I ask you one question? It's normally like six. So this is the...
Right. So totally unrelated. One is that you had brought up with the sperm donor that Moshe Feinstein and I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. It's late.
Right.
Go on.
But they were saying non-Jewish. But doesn't that also bring up an issue in terms of if there are multiple people using this means of having a child, then you still are back to square one that you could possibly have a related sibling out there that
genetically, not halachically.
Okay.
Halachically, there's no yichus, there's no lineage to it with a non-Jew. All right, but yours is genetically, so you do the appropriate genetic testing, as we encourage. For example, Bruria now does genetic testing for all the right reasons. I think that every young couple before they get married or before they get serious should do genetic testing. It obviates a whole bunch of issues. Just being one of the most, perhaps most random outside ones, there's a whole bunch of other issues. Or Moshe Feinstein encourages it also, you know, that it should be done.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
Plus that the surrogate mother has then the
that, according to Avraham Soloveitchik, yeah.
Then, take that one step further, then when these children are born, and typically the idea of a surrogacy, that it's going back to the donor
right.
parent, then doesn't that child, and in the case of adoption, isn't that nurturing count? I mean, if you count the 41 days till birth, As defining it, why shouldn't it count the rest of their lives?
So the nurturing that halacha is discussing is the fetal development until it becomes a human being, which is before the woman gives birth. The minute the child is born, the child is no longer quasi, even before the child is born, at the point in time that it leaves the vaginal canal, it's no longer considered a quasi human being. You cannot, in other words, in utero, for example, if the woman's life is at risk and the fetus's life at risk, the halacha clearly indicates that you sacrifice the fetus to save the woman. The minute the child is born, or even during it going through the vaginal canal, the birth canal, at a certain point, then what happens is that's no longer the case. They're both considered full human beings. The point being that, of course, as I said earlier to the gentleman, of course, the parents that nurture this child have a status of parents from an adoptive perspective. They have a status of the parents because they are the parents that nurture this child. But they're not considered the only parents. The surrogate would be considered a parent also. So if, God forbid, the surrogate passed away, the child, halachically, would have to sit Shiva, even though the mother who's nurturing this child, the one who does the homework, makes the lunches, makes sure that the laundry is clean, makes sure the child goes to bed, and all fill-in-the-blank stuff, even though she's doing all the real heavy lifting,
the surrogate, who did heavy lifting for 9 months, if the surrogate passes away, that child halachically would have to sit shiva. That's the point that I'm trying to communicate in the most starkest way that I can. Now, it might sound a little emotionally challenged, and I'm not trying to be not sensitive. Just the opposite. By creating these strong paradigms that I've tried to articulate, it allows there to be the appropriate protocols for couples to be able to actualize the dream of having children. And if we didn't have these strict protocols, it would not allow those who are committed to a halakhic process to be able to actualize the dream of having children. Thank you.
I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Thank Rabbi Brander, of course, for his beautiful and very informative lecture. His staff at Center for Jewish Future was very helpful in this, and also Steve Deitch and Rabbi Kaufman were instrumental in making it happen. So thank everybody. Remind you to take a brochure, please, and an envelope for Just One Life on your way out in the back. Thank you for coming.
What?
You don't have to bleed sores if I start asking you
what it was. It's fine.
Thank you. Question. What is
YConnex? YConnex is a program that helps young men and women meet each other. They have a whole website. They have around 10 or 15 dating connectors. They have all different types of programs.
Is it different than So You Assign Me?
I'm sorry?
Is it different than So You Assign Me?
And actually, the plus of it is over So You Assign Me is, first of all, it has the dating connectors. They meet in person in the programs. And our relationship with So You Assign Me is such is that anyone who signs up on the YU thing, can the dating connectors can see the whole So You at Sinai database, but the So You at Sinai people, unless the YU person permits it, the So You at Sinai people cannot see the YU thing.
So how do they find this? Because I do this all the time.
Oh yeah, we'd love to. Yeah, we can use as much help as we can.
I really do all the time.
You send me an email. I give you my, and I'll connect you. The person who runs it for us is Efrat Sabalowski. Vincent Sabalowski. I would love help. We would love help.
I spent at least 15 hours.
That would be great. I appreciate it. It was worth coming just for this.
Oh, good. Thanks.
My name is Stuart Kilstein. I'm Yaakov and Zachary.
Oh, hi.
They would have been here, but they went to Boca this weekend.
Oh, okay. It's a pleasure.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. It's been regards.
Kind of very, very basic. I never had a chance to watch the movie Kadosh.
Sorry?
The movie Kadosh. One of the years it was what is the problem? How is such that?
I don't think there's a problem.
Because really it comes across as it's either divorce or you marry a second wife.
No.
So that's not being held by anybody by the time I